And its leadership, we thank you for joining us today here in the auditorium as well as online. We have been talking about the story behind the story. We've been talking about the Christmas story, and what we've tried to do with this series is kind of cut through some of the lore, some of the things related to the story of Christmas that, quite frankly, is probably a little more, and in some cases outright more fiction than fact. And in doing that, we wanted to just cut through the chase to talk about the Christmas season, talk about where it came from, its origins, and what it means to us today. As I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, we do not know the day that Jesus was born. In fact, more than likely, he was born in the fall or the spring versus December 25th. We know that the term Christmas did not come about till the 3rd century. And we know that as far as individually, in terms of us and our faith as individual Christians, we have the right to observe or not observe any day the way we individually choose. As Paul says in Romans 14, one man considers one day more important than another. Another man looks at every day alike. Let them be convinced in their own mind. And as I pointed out, I feel like we still want to take advantage of a holiday, much like we take advantage of Thanksgiving and Mother's Day and other holidays that will help us think about some things that are already in the Bible. We know that Jesus was born probably in a small house in Bethlehem. The common notion that he was born in a barn or in a cave, as I noted a couple of weeks ago, is probably not correct. But the house was crowded, and they didn't have room in the guest room of the house, so they had to stay in the living quarters where there would have been a manger for the animals that they brought in during the night. So that is the context in which Jesus was born. The important thing to remember is this, though. Paul says, when the time was right, when the time was perfect, when the fullness of time came, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law. Jesus came. God was not taken by surprise with the sin of mankind. God was working all along to bring us back to him, as we saw in some of the prophecies that we looked at from the Old Testament, in the fact that Jesus would be born in Bethlehem, the Messiah would be born there, and all of those things. And last week, Nick looked at the idea of the genealogy of Christ and why that was so important. The Messiah was to come and come through the line of David and be a descendant of David and be a king to reign forever. And we see that in those genealogies. And yet, even within those genealogies, we see what God is doing. We see that God is identifying with us. He is identifying with broken and needy and hurt and flawed people, as we saw last week. So this week, what are we going to talk about? We're going to talk about the Christmas story from the angle of John the Apostle. And John the Apostle does something very interesting compared to what Matthew and Luke does. His story begins somewhere else. He says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was everywhere, and God spoke. God said, let there be light. And there was light. That's where he starts. In the beginning, before creation, before God created the expanse of the universe and worked in fulfilling the plan that he had in his mind. In the beginning was the Word. In the beginning, God. In the beginning, God created. In the beginning was the Word. And we see that very thing in the early chapters of Genesis. God speaking and the Word working and God saying something and something coming about that was not there. Someone is called the Word. Not a word, not some word, but the Word. And when you think of the Word or a word expresses a thought or an idea about something or something. In the creation account in the book of Genesis, we see God speaking the Word and we see creation coming about. In the beginning was the Word. But the Word became human. In John 1:14 it says, the Word became flesh and made His dwelling among us. And we have seen His glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. The Word became flesh. The Word became a human being. And didn't just become a human being. As we look just briefly at the story of the birth of Jesus, born in humble settings in a small house that was crowded, as an ordinary human being would be born in that day, and made His dwelling among us. The Word became a human being under ordinary circumstances and in extraordinary circumstances. And that's the wonder of this story about a God who makes a decision to enter our world in a way that was never done before. And He chose to pitch His tent. Literally, that's what it means when He made His dwelling among us. He tabernacled among us. He didn't just make a quick appearance and leave. He dwelt among us and lived like us in every way that we live. And we have seen His glory. So He's born in a small house. The midwife was probably there. All the things that happen when a child is born in the normal human way, it was done. And yet at the same time, we see miraculous elements in the story of the birth of Christ. The idea of being conceived by the power of the Holy Spirit. The angels who appeared to shepherds watching over their fields and flocks by night. The star, the sign that led the Magi, eventually when Jesus was over a year old, to worship Him and bow down before Him. The Word became human. But the Word also was with God. The Word was with God. He was with God in the beginning. God is a personal God. God is not some static, monolithic God. God is interpersonal. God is relationship. There existed, even before God created human beings, there was a relationship within deity, within the Godhead, even before He decided to create human beings. And so we see here this Word that became flesh and dwelt among us, obviously referring to Jesus Christ. He was with God. He was with God in the beginning. He was with Him even before the beginning of time. Now think about that one for just a minute and what that means. That means there was not a time that the Son of God did not exist. He was in the beginning, and He was in the beginning with God. There was a relationship that He had with God the Father, even before the creation. I love what Jesus says in His prayer in John 17, before He is going back, He's going to die, going to be crucified, going to be raised from the dead, eventually ascend to the Father. And He prays to God the Father before that time. And He says in John 17, "And now, Father, glorify Me in Your presence with the glory that I had." Listen to this. "Glorify Me, Father, with the glory that I had with You before the world began." The Word was with God. Now, the purpose of this lesson is not to go in depth into the intricate details and the complexities of the nature of God. This will not be a sermon on the triune God. Some people use the term the Trinity to describe God. And yet, from a biblical standpoint, especially with what we see in the New Testament, it becomes even more clear that there is this eternal relationship that existed within the one God. And with three beings who could be described in such a way that they would be described as one God. And yet they were different and distinct and yet still perfectly aligned as one. The Word was with God. He was with God in the beginning. Face to face. That's what this word means, this preposition. It's not just being around someone. It's being there. It's being face to face. We can talk about being with people all the time. Hey, listen, I've been with James Taylor. I've been with John Denver. I've been with Josh Groban. I've been with the band Boston and been with the band Kansas. I've been with them, but that with is a little bit different than this with. I was with them at a concert with thousands of other people. They didn't know I was there, but I could properly say, I've been with Josh Groban. Yeah, we've been together. He may have been 500 feet away from me and might not know who I am, but I'm with him. We're together. We're in the same place. But this idea expresses this face-to-face, close, intimate knowledge. He was with God in the beginning, but the Word, now this is so important here. The Word was God. The Word that became flesh, became a human being, and dwelt among us, was with God and was God. I know in some ways that's hard to understand. I'm not going to try to explain in every way and every term the complexities of all of these issues. In some ways, they just blow my mind, quite frankly. How God can be one and yet exist eternally in the relationship of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. But I do know that when John says the Word was God, that's what he means. We looked at the prophecy from Isaiah chapter 9 a couple of weeks ago, and it says there, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulders, and he will have a kingdom that lasts forever, and will sit on the throne of David forever and ever." But listen to how he was described. "And he shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Almighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace." Jesus made it clear when he walked this earth that he was not just some ordinary man. When he was having a discussion with some of the Jews and they were, quite frankly, not believing what he was saying, and they were kind of pushing him, and he was having this discussion with them, and they were talking about Abraham, and they were talking about their sin. At one point, Jesus talked about Abraham rejoicing to see his day. And then they said, "Well, you're not greater than Abraham. How could Abraham know about you?" And he says to them, "Before Abraham was, I am." He ascribed to himself, as he had a conversation with some Jews who were having a conversation with him, he uses the very name of God, "I am." Who are you, God? "I am. Before Abraham was, I am." When he was raised from the dead and made appearances to the disciples for a period of time after his resurrection, Thomas had doubts. But when Thomas finally saw the risen Christ, saw the scars, he looked at him and said, "My Lord and my God." Jesus forgave sins in ways that only God could forgive sins. And there were times when he would do so and people would say, "Who are you? Only God can forgive sins." And worship. You remember what the Magi did when they came to Jesus, the wise men? They offered him gifts, and what did they do? They bowed down to worship him. In the book of Revelation, we have Jesus described as the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the clincher, at least in this text in John chapter 1, is this: the Word was Creator. Listen to this. Through Him, that is the Word, which was with God and was God and became flesh, through Him all things were made. Without Him nothing was made that has been made. In Him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Only God can create. Only God can make something out of nothing. Now, I don't know where you stand right now, personally, on your belief in God or a creator God. But I will just step out on a limb and say, personally, I believe that it takes more faith to believe that all of this is just chance, all of it's just accident, that in terms of a plan or a meaning or a greater design, all of this is just the result of chaos. There's no mind, there's no power, there's no God. It just happened. Or you can choose to believe, and I believe there's evidence, not getting into it today, that there is design, there is purpose, there is planning, there is order. And we see God's creative hand in everything around us, even down to our DNA. It's like a computer program. It's the design for us to make us who we are. Personally, I don't believe that just happened. We see design and a creator all around us. So why did God create? Once again, I'm not going to go deeply into that this morning, but I want to touch on it just a little bit. I want to make it clear that I believe that God did not create us, human beings, because He needed us, or because He was lonely and was incomplete. There's an old spiritual that talks about God being lonely and wanting to, you know, have somebody to relate to, and so He created human beings. Well, listen, there was already relationship in the Godhead. There's relationship and love and sharing and giving, even within the innate nature of God Himself. He didn't need us. He wasn't lonely. But He longs for us. And He created human beings because He is a God of love, and He is a God who blesses, and He is a God who gives, and that was a part of His nature. But please don't believe for a minute that it's because there was something lacking in His nature as God that needed to be complete. God created out of love. God created because He wants to bless. And even with that, after creation, God is still transcendent over and above His creation. God's nature is wholly other. He is different from us. He is above us. He's greater than us. We can't even begin to imagine the magnitude of God. I feel inadequate even talking about it sometimes, because I know I can't begin to convey the power of what this means. But the fact is, this Creator God, this one who was the Word and was with God and was God, through Him, everything that has been made was made. And he is the one who gives life and light. He is the one who recreates. He is the one who gives new life. He is the one who enables us to be and experience the idea of being born again. The Word was Creator, but he has revealed himself personally. This is the glory of God clothed in the ordinary. And so it says in the same passage in the 18th verse, no one has ever seen God. And I love the way that NIV translates this. This is a good translation. No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father before creation even, has made him known. God reveals himself personally as a human being to reach out to us and save us and love us. Do you remember when Moses is struggling in the book of Exodus and he's just wondering if he's up to the task of leading God's people? There have been frustrations and complaining and difficulties, and Moses is just, he's having some doubts. He's wondering whether he can pull this off. But he has to understand that it's not him pulling it off. It's God working through him and for him. And at one point in the conversation Moses has with God, God could appear in a theophany and talk to him and others in a way, just like in the garden with Adam and Eve. But it's an appearance and then they leave. Not like what happened to Jesus, born, live completely as a human being. But Moses says to him, show me your glory. Show me your glory. I need to see it. I need to experience your greatness and your grandeur up close, face to face. And God says to him, you couldn't even look at me. You can't even look at me and live. How great, how awesome, how holy other is God. We can't even begin to imagine this God who lives in unapproachable light. And yet Moses says, show me your glory. And God says, okay, you can't see my full glory. You can't see my full essence. If you did, you would die. But what I will do is I want you to get behind that rock and I'm going to pass by and you will see my back. And that's what happened. It was a portion, if I can use the word. It was an expression of the glory of God, but not the full, complete glory. That was a glory that was too big. And so he says, no one's ever seen God. We couldn't see God in his pure, unadulterated, pure, unfiltered essence and live. But the one and only Son, who is himself God, has made him known. Has made him known. As he talked to his disciples who struggled with so many of these things and didn't understand, and they're trying to figure out what's going on, Jesus is getting ready to face his death, and Jesus is speaking to them there the last night before he's arrested and then crucified. One of the disciples says, show us the Father. Show us the Father. And Jesus says to him, haven't I been with you long enough for you to know if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. He has made him known. That brings me to this question. For you, for us, for Jesus, are you too big for your britches? Now that's a term that's was popularized in the South. According to some research I did, the first time this is found in print is when Davy Crockett is talking about Andrew Jackson. And so he's given an account of his tour and his exploration and everything that he did. You remember the show and the song, Davy, Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier. Y'all remember that. But anyway, he said this. I digress. He said, I myself was one of the first to fire a gun under Andrew Jackson. I helped to give him all his glory. Crockett saying this about Jackson. But I liked him well once. But when a man gets too big for his britches, I say goodbye. So they didn't get along toward the end. He thought he was a little bit too big for his britches. We use that term to describe somebody who thinks too much of themselves, or they are trying to complete a task or do something that they can't do, or maybe a parent or a grandparent says to the kid, you know, you're getting a little too big for your britches. You need to be humble. But how does this apply to Jesus, and what does this have to do with what we've been talking about? It is this grand truth that is all about the story of the entrance of Jesus into the world, and that is that God condescends himself to us. And we think of the word condescend or condescending to us, it almost automatically means something negative. If Brian is going to be condescending toward me, what is he doing? He thinks he's bigger and better than me, or smarter, or whatever it might be, and he responds to me or treats me in a way that he's looking down at me. He is conceited. He's bigger. He's better. I'm less, okay? Well, another word that we might use might be the word patronizing, okay? But they're not the same. Condescension does not always mean you're looking down on someone. Condescension, in its original meaning, simply means someone that willingly places themselves at a lower position for the good or the blessings of others. Was Jesus too big for his britches? That's a trick question. David, was Jesus too big for his britches? Mm-mm. He wasn't. In one sense. But in another sense, he was, in the sense of how does God, how does deity, how does the divine, how does creator condescend to us and become a human being? How does God fit into the breaches of humanity? Well, there have to be some adjustments. And not that he gives up his divine nature or his deity or his godness. He doesn't give that up. But he willingly places limitations upon himself for us. When Jesus was asked, when are you coming back? Jesus said, no man knows the day or the hour, only the Father. There were things in his humanity that he willingly laid aside, some things, not his divine nature, but some of the privileges and rights and prerogatives of what it means to be God. He gave some of those things up so that he could truly become human in every single way. Is he superior? Yeah, he's superior. But how did he use his power? As God and man. He condescends to us so that we can experience this. Out of his fullness, we've received grace in place of grace already given. For the law is given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. He condescends himself to become one of us so that he could be our substitute and receive in his person. This is God. This is the judge. This is the one who can condemn, becomes the one who is condemned. God, in the person of Jesus, becomes the condemned and is our substitute so that we can go free. And he can do this for all of us because he is God. Theoretically, if you could live without sin for your whole life and be a substitute for somebody, you could be a substitute for one person. Theoretically, if any of us could live without sin and live a perfect life, substitute one for one, because he is not just man, but he is also God. He is able to be the substitute for all of us because of his divine nature and our fullness. So what does this mean in terms of some quick points? Number one, anytime you do something like this, there's a risk for rejection. And here's the sad part in this account. It says he was in the world and he made the world, but the world didn't recognize him nor receive him. I remember growing up, I remember several years ago as our kids were growing up, they played with kids in the neighborhood. There was a boy across the street who would yell at his parents all the time out in the front yard. And he would scream at the top of his lungs if he was upset with them, "I hate you! I hate you!" And they'd say, I'm sure they got it figured out. But, I thought, it's inappropriate, isn't it, for a child who is there because of his parents to say, "I don't want you, I don't need you." And that's the risk that God takes. That's the risk that Jesus takes, that we will not receive him, but there is a reward, and it is this: to all who did receive him and believed in his name, he gave the right to be called children of God. So that's the blessing. That's the promise. That is what he has done for us. And so, takeaway one. What does this mean? You know, the main purpose of this sermon is just to help you appreciate, you know, what is happening at a cosmic level in all of this. The first thing we do, we just humble ourselves. I bow down before God. I'm humbled. I don't deserve it. I don't deserve life. I shouldn't have a sense of entitlement because everything I am and everything that I have that is good is a gift. I'm humbled. And so I sing along with the song, "When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain I count but loss and pour contempt on all my pride." I'm humbled. It not only affects my relationship with God, it affects how I treat others. It affects whether I'm willing to lower myself. Do things beneath my dignity to help and serve others and love them when they're unlovable. And last but not least, here's the last takeaway. If you need help, if you're struggling, if you're hurting, if you don't know what direction to go, if you're dealing with a situation right now and you don't see the answers, there is a God who gets you. He gets you. Listen, God experienced, please don't miss this, it's so important. God knew what it meant to be human in one sense. God's omniscient. He's all-knowing. So he created human beings. He saw what happened. He saw the sin. He saw all the awful things that came about because of our rebellion. He knows it. But there's one thing that's different in knowing about and experiencing. This is the wonder of God with us, Emmanuel. God experiences really and truly what it means to be a human being in the person of Jesus. So you can't say, "Look, God doesn't understand, God doesn't know." He does. He doesn't just know about. He has been there and done that. And thank God, even with all the self-limitations he placed upon himself as a human being, he withstood sin. fought through the power of the Holy Spirit and knowing what was at stake, he went to that cross, a perfect sacrifice. And because of that, he is able to help. He's able to help. I want you to appreciate that and the magnitude of what it means in the story behind the story of what Christmas is all about. So, what story are you writing? How does his story fit into your story? We're going to talk more about that next week, about how we write our story in relationship to his. In the meantime, let me just ask you to do this. Let's all of us, as we move forward, this day, this week, this month, this year, in our lives, let us all strive to never be too big for our britches.